Hey everyone, it's Dorian here. Obviously, most of you know about the demonstrations going on all around the world protesting police brutality against Black Americans. Max and I started this podcast about death with the mission of giving a voice to marginalized people, and it is in this spirit that we want to give our full support to the Black Lives Matter movement. The murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and countless others are unacceptable. We need to see their killers brought to justice, and we need fundamental change in this country's criminal justice system. We want to ask that our listeners consider helping in any way that you can. Max and I have been participating in the peaceful protests here in Ohio, and getting involved is as easy as searching for events online and showing up. You can march with the protesters or provide supplies like water, eyewash, snacks. If you can't attend a protest, you can donate to bail funds and other organizations that are supporting the cause. And you can condemn the injustice that you see using social media or any platform you might have. You can support Black-owned businesses. You can fight against the gentrification that pushes people to the fringe in your cities. You can build inroads with your community. Listen to their struggles. Do your part in any way that you can. Any way that you can help give justice and equal opportunity to our Black brothers and sisters is much appreciated. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Oh man, I'm excited about today's topic.
Bon appetit, baby.
Welcome to the Pre-Dead Boys. It is the award-winning podcast about the history and culture of death and decomposition. My name is Dorian. With me, virtually, is Max. How you doing, Max?
Doing pretty well over here. My dog, as you saw, has been spayed. So she has been sedated pretty heavily. So I think she's sleeping now.
That's good. That's good that she's calm now. She was yipping earlier about... you know, it sounded like either an intruder kicked through your window and was breaking into your home to mug you and your wife and steal all your belongings, or you just accidentally scooted your microphone a little bit and it created a weird scraping sound that caused her. Either one of those would be enough to cause her to go into a panic. So I figured it had to be one of the two.
She is 0 to 100 constantly. So
she's very cute, though. You keep posting photos of her, and she's got, like, I don't know, what do you call her fur pattern? It's like a speckled kind of blonde, gray, sandy...
Brindle. She's brindle.
Brindle?
Brindle.
Like the fly?
I don't know what that is. What?
The David Cronenberg film.
Oh, is the guy's name Brindle?
Brindle fly. I think it's Brundle, but the joke was lost on you either way, so it doesn't matter.
We watched Katrina and I watched The Thing recently, and I forgot that the first like 20 minutes of that movie are centered around a dog, which she did not like. Even when the dog was just on the screen and not even barking, she was barking at it and trying to find it. So, did not
like. In a weird sort of way, too. I think that that's. Like, I like that movie because it's scary, and it's really scary when a movie doesn't shy away from fucking with dogs. You know, on the one hand, I don't want them to mess with the dogs, but on the other hand, I'm like, it is extra scary when the dogs are the agent of chaos.
Mutating.
You know? Yeah, because you and I would be susceptible to that. You and I would just see a dog and be like, oh, puppers. Yeah. Oh, doggo.
Doggo.
A heckin' good doggo.
Bork.
Right? but Julep is the smart one. Julep saw the threat. So kudos to Julep. Shout out to Pre-Dead Boys mascot, Julep.
Good girl, Julep. A little pep talk there.
Anyway, We should stop talking about dogs and start talking about death. Max, what have you prepared for us to discuss today?
So where we're living, quarantine is still attempting to go strong. Some places are breaking that.
I was going to say for the most part,
but we're trying. And I've been trying to find like a balance of how much to support local business and eat out and how much to stay inside. So at this point, Katrina and I, like, we get carry out once a week and make food 6 nights a week. So I've been cooking like a lot of food and my kitchen sucks. But like tonight I'm making potato curry. I've made like chicken tagine, French onion soup. I've been making a lot of turkey and Swiss grilled cheese. Have you been cooking much? You a chef?
Not that much. That's way more than I've been doing. I'll meal prep one thing and get 3 or 4 meals out of it. But I also work in a grocery store that has lots of food. So, and today I was just a complete lazy piece of shit and ate leftover pizza. So it's kind of 50-50, but man, your meal prep game is strong. Kudos to you.
Where was the pizza from?
Granddad's.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, we got a granddad's pizza, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 blocks from our house or something. Like, it's so good. It's kind of a weekly, every week me and my roommates get granddad's pizza and hang out. And yeah, we miraculously had some leftover from last night.
Dope. One of my top 2 in Columbus, maybe top 3. I don't know.
Really? What are the other top 1 or 2?
Massey's and probably Meister's in Grandview.
Ooh, never had Meister's.
It's good. It's like deep dish.
Ooh, love deep dish. My guts do not love deep dish. My guts don't like cheese.
So I have also been making a lot of bread too, which is just, by the way, I've been making tons of bread.
You making a sourdough?
No, like rosemary garlic and then like a honey almond cranberry.
Ooh, baby.
Yeah.
Mmm.
So I've been trying to find a way to combine my new cooking hobby with death. And I think today, I think I've done it. So today,
I've poisoned my wife.
Today, we're going to be talking about death and food. Although I think the French onion soup did come kind of close to poisoning both of us.
Ooh, that was a joke. Yeah. Please don't poison you or your wife, please.
No, intentionally. So without further ado, let's crack into today's food topic with the official Pre-Dead Boys crack into the topic moment. On my end, this is brought to you by Clear American Moscow Mule flavor.
Ooh, is that the same as the mojito? Yeah, you're showing me the label and it's got non-alcoholic. Very nice. Well, speaking of new seltzers, I guess I picked up the vibes, the culinary vibes. Ooh. Exploring new culinary territory. I'm trying Aha Black Cherry Coffee Seltzer.
Oh.
I know it sounds crazy, but I've had it before and it's very, very good.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's crack into it then.
Hell yeah.
I love ginger.
Yeah.
Big
it's a great flavor.
So I know this may seem like a weird one. And when I was prepping this, I was kind of thinking like, is this going to be the next Trains episode? And then I thought that if we had like a Pre-Dead Boys bingo board, I think like the free space would be like, I talk shit about Trains, which everyone has said is fine. So
you are the biggest critic of our Trains episode. I actually thought it was a lot of fun. But you seem to remember nothing but negative things about it.
Just think about the band a lot.
Fair enough.
I do think this food episode is going to be very fun. So back when I worked at the library, I would walk through like the death and dying section a lot. The 390s. And there was a book that always stuck out to me. And no one ever like checked the book out. No one ever checked the book out or read it or anything. But it was titled Being Dead is No Excuse. And it was right next to all like the Caitlin Doughty stuff. So I was like, oh, maybe it's, you know, similar or about like mortuary science or something like that. And sometimes I would pull it off the shelf and then I would remember, oh, wait, this is just like a cookbook.
Like a death cookbook?
Yeah, it was half cookbook and half like guide on how to throw a southern funeral.
Okay.
So it definitely intrigued me, but it also talked a lot about aspic. Have you ever had aspic?
No, what's aspic?
Aspic is like gelatin, but made of meat.
Okay.
So it's like clear. It's real. It's like meat jelly.
Okay. Is that like the stuff that congeals on the bottom of, like when you get a rotisserie chicken?
No.
And it's got that like, okay.
No, it's like jello made to taste like meat.
Very weird.
Very weird. We will talk about some good food in a bit though. But the thing that did really interest me about the book was that on the back of it was this pull quote.
Nobody in the world eats better than the bereaved Southerner.
Which is very good.
That I can't tell if that's a brag or an insult.
I think it's a brag. Because the more I looked through this book, the more it like stuck with me. And especially lately, being really interested in the relationship between food and death. That's a big thing in the South. So I don't know if this is true for you, but food has always been like a pretty significant part of funerals in my family. So I have roots in like a lot of small East Pennsylvania coal mining towns like Lansford and Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, which used to be named Mock Chunk.
Oh, that was a downgrade. Mock Chunk is hilarious.
They renamed it. So all the houses out there are really small, but my family is big. And so whenever we had a funeral, it was either like we can like rent space in a VFW hall, or we're going to go to a banquet room in a restaurant. And so we usually just went to like a banquet room at like a TJ's or something.
Okay.
So because this association was instilled in me from a really early age, I kind of think that food actually played a pretty significant role in the foundation of my like interest in death positivity and not being weirded out by funerals and stuff like that.
Hmm.
So like, do you have a history of food at funerals or anything?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, food is just a celebrated, enjoyed thing in my family, period. You know, like I don't have any specific association with it with funerals, but I got a lot of great cooks in my family. Any family gathering or potluck or whatever we do tends to have some really good food. My mom's side of the family is mostly Italian, so a lot of pastas, a lot of lasagnas, a lot of good saucy, cheesy stuff, which destroys me. but, you know, I love it nonetheless. But no, nothing specifically tied to funerals. I feel like my family has dealt with funerals as they've come up and kind of gone for like whatever the most convenient solution is. Cause my family, I think about the funerals that I've been to in it, they're not fun affairs. They're kind of like, this sucks. We're going to do this. We're going to spend time together. But like, everyone's real somber. And I think that has shaped my perspective on like what I want my funeral to be, is I don't want it to be as somber and, honestly kind of sad as like, you know, some of what I've seen on both sides of my family. But yeah, as far as food, I don't think there's anything like specifically tied to funeral celebrations that like we've done, as far as I can remember. So I'm curious about this. I'm curious to see like what you researched, and you know, it's a little bit of a foreign concept to me to like tie food to funerals in some special way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense because, I mean, from what I know about you, you're not affiliated with the American South in any way, really, correct?
Nah. Yeah. I say y'all because I like the word y'all, but there's no... I'm a poser.
So, I mean, food at funerals in like a big way is an American Southern tradition. Folks in the South really heap on comfort food. Like, it's a big deal. And that kind of stems from the fact that when you're grieving, it's really tough to cook. Maybe you have to come in from out of town because a parent died or something, and you're operating out of a hotel. A lot of hotels don't have like nice kitchens or anything. Maybe you just spent a lot of money on a funeral. It's difficult. And the idea behind this is that like providing comfort food to the family is a very cool way to not allow someone to grieve by themselves.
Hmm.
And as we kind of go further into the origins of this custom, I was looking into groups that do funeral meals, and the biggest ones in America are Southerners, the Amish, and the Mormons. So all these groups share a pretty deep history of farming and working the land. And if you imagine someone in your family has died, even if you take 3 days off from farming, that's 3 days where you can't be harvesting or taking food into town to sell. It creates like a backlog of work.
Right.
So when you're living day to day, those 3 days can really hurt, especially when you are thinking about it on top of funeral expenses, maybe having to feed family coming into town. And because of that, there was a massive spike in funeral food at a very particular point in American history. And I'm going to have you read about it right now.
During the Great Depression, the funeral meal transitioned from a social nicety to a necessity. Since many women were still barred from workplaces, a male death in the family meant a significant hit to an already reduced income. Given food was already hard to come by, a grieving family rarely had the resources, time, or energy to travel to multiple markets to put a meal together. Thus, the U.S. Department of Agriculture encouraged people to celebrate large dinners, including funerals, potluck style, to reduce strain on the individual. As a result, the status of foods like ham salad, funeral potatoes, and, in the South, brown bag chicken were cemented as funeral staples.
Yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense. Like, if you are going to have a lot of people coming into town for a funeral, that is a big financial strain. But, you know, the attitude of like everyone chips in was really prevalent in America at the time. So they just moved it over to applying to funerals.
Right. But I like that. I like that. Like that in a way makes it more social. You know, it goes from being like kind of a voluntary thing to like, oh shit, we need help. There is a big strain. But, you know, in the process, you and I are in a church where we kind of do potlucks on a pretty frequent basis. And it's nice when like one person in particular brings something really good. Another person brings something crazy that you've never tried before. And like, it becomes this communal fun sort of social gathering that, I would imagine that like just having a potluck on principle would kind of make it a little bit more enjoyable, right? I mean, maybe a weird thing to say about this period of time, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, culture is very based around food, and food usually makes people feel better. So I assume that, you know, it would make even a funeral more enjoyable at the time, you know?
Sure.
So this is where we can start talking about how funeral food kind of looks and functions differently than typical food. Let's start with ham salad. So this is an aspic, but I can't even read this because it repulses me. So I'm going to have you read this bit here from Atlas Obscura. They have like a food website called Gastro Obscura. It's just weird stuff about food, and it's delightful. It's awesome.
Okay. Some funeral traditions offer solemn, moving moments of connection. Others can lead more toward frivolous status symbols. In late 19th century England, ham was one such status symbol. Receiving a stylish service came to be known as being, quote, buried with ham, as not just anyone could afford such meaty extravagance at their funeral tea. Is that right? Funeral tea?
Yeah. Like they would have like an afternoon lunch.
Oh. Yeah. Like spill the tea, sis?
Spill the tea, sis.
While ham isn't quite the display of opulence it once was, it's still prevalent at British and American funerals in baked and cold-cut forms. In the United States' upper Midwest, mid-Atlantic, and Southeast regions, this culinary tradition evolved into the mayo-based delight known as the ham salad. Though some cooks added in the likes of hard-boiled eggs, celery, or onions, the basic recipe for the salad used ground ham, mayonnaise, and pickle relish. Slathered between slices of white bread or atop crackers, the cheap filling spread rose in prominence at Depression-era American funeral luncheons. I'm sorry, excuse me. Yeah, this disgusting blend of ground meat and mayonnaise. I think we're on the same page here, right? Like, this is a fucking atrocity and must be destroyed at all costs, yes?
So, I mean, here's the thing. I love chicken salad. I have been making a lot of chicken salad with, like, you just take the chicken out and use chickpeas instead. Like, you just mash up chickpeas.
Yeah, okay.
Sub it in for chicken. Mm-hmm. It's great. It rules. With some like almonds and craisins. It kicks ass. I do not fuck with ham salad because I do not fuck with cubed ham.
It's disgusting.
I've seen it at grocery stores and it looks like vomit. It's terrible. I do not fuck with white bread.
Oh, any white bread at all.
I will sometimes. You know what? No, I do not like white bread.
Never? Have you ever had eggs in a basket?
Is that where you like cut a hole in a piece of toast?
Uh-huh. Well, you cut a hole in the bread, and then you put the bread on the pan that you're cooking your eggs on, and then you put the egg inside of the hole, and it kind of fills in the gap of the bread. You make it kick-ass, like you can do it up French toast style.
Oh.
You can just put some hot sauce on it. It's great. Eggs in a basket are great, and they're best made with white bread, in my opinion. So there are some applications for white bread that I enjoy, but do you equate it to the pink vomit that is ham salad?
I just think, I don't know, it's bad, man. It's not like as repulsive. But I think, like, I don't know, I would never choose white bread.
That's fair. We can agree on ham salad being an atrocity, though, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. If you enjoy ham salad, you're a criminal.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Unless it's, like, at a funeral and it's your weird family tradition thing, that's gross as hell. So, now that we can put that far, far behind us.
Thank God.
We can talk about funeral potatoes, which, despite the name, sound much better. So funeral potatoes are basically just like a shredded potato casserole. So like shredded potatoes, cream of chicken, mushrooms, and then you pour cornflake cereal on the top. And that just helps it last longer and give it some more like oomph and weight to it.
It also adds some carbs to it because you want to add a little bit of carbs to your potatoes. And if you're going to really make a coma inducing food, you need it. You know, you need those carbs.
Well, that's what comfort food is. It's just carb food, man.
True that.
Brown bag chicken also sounds great.
Yeah, also, what is that?
So it kind of sounds like witchcraft, but apparently it's totally okay to get like a paper grocery bag and roast a chicken in it.
Really?
Like somehow the bag doesn't catch fire. I don't know if it's just because you're roasting it at like 200 degrees and you do like low and slow.
Huh.
But the bag allows enough moisture to like be locked in that the meat stays tender, but the skin can also crisp up. So you're getting like best of both worlds there. I don't understand it, and it baffles me. Are you looking at it right now?
Yeah, I'm trying to look up photos, and I don't know, it kind of just looks like, oh man, Creole garlic injected brown paper bag chicken. Oh, I'm going to exit this window now because that's distracting. That looks delicious.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. But if you know, if you were in the Great Depression, which actually doesn't really sound that great, if you were if you were alive at that time and you were able to provide a family with a chicken to eat, that was a pretty significant gift.
I can totally understand that. I mean, we are in a less economically strained time, at least right now. But I definitely feel loved when someone gives me an entire chicken.
I'll keep that in mind for your birthday.
Yeah.
Or something. So this funeral food isn't only relegated to American culture, though. That Gastro Obscura article lists a few other interesting things, such as halva, which is a Middle Eastern dish, and kaliva, which is big in the Balkans and Greece. So can you describe what halva and kaliva are really quick?
Most versions of halva appear in the form of a sweet, dense confection that's enjoyed year-round. But in Iran, Turkey, and Armenia, halva is also strongly associated with times of mourning. Many recipes require just sugar, water, flour, and butter, although some add funerary aromatics or rose water. Kaliva, particularly prevalent in Greece, is built around unprocessed kernels of wheat, otherwise known as wheat berries. Just preparing the berries makes for a time-consuming tribute, taking 2 days to soak, cook, drain, and dry the kernels. During this time, relatives are supposed to pray and think of the deceased. Cooks often add a generous dusting of confectioner's sugar, then use nuts, Jordan almonds, or dried fruit to form a cross and the initials of the deceased, with a few sprigs of parsley serving as grass beneath the cross. The mound evokes the burial site itself. Despite its sweetness, kaliva is a sacred food that's meant to be eaten solemnly and not for pleasure.
Yeah, a lot of recipes that I could find online for kaliva make like, you know, like a normal sized cake, like a, you know, 12 inch or whatever. But the serving size is listed as like 40 because you're not supposed to eat more than a bite of it in remembrance, which is interesting.
I would not do well at a Greek funeral.
Greece.
I would get kicked out for eating all of the kaliva.
So there's a lot of other really good examples of burial food in that article. And we'll go ahead and post the link in the show notes, but it's cool how culturally people use food and relate it to death. So I did some like polling and asked around on our Discord, which we should plug now. If you are interested, let us know and we can get you a link to a little, Discord chat that a bunch of, pre-dead folks are on.
We'll send you an invite. It's fun.
So I got some really cool responses from people around the world about what they do at funerals. Emmy seconded that funeral potatoes are a big thing. Brindis from Iceland mentioned Kleina, which is like a fried dough donut thing.
Ooh, which sounds great. Good.
Did you see the photo of Flatkaka?
Flatkaka?
No. Which is, it's like unleavened bread covered in smoked lamb.
Ooh, man. Sounds good.
Yeah.
I picked the worst possible recording session to not eat before we recorded.
Iceland's got to figure it out, man. Allison and Heather both echoed my like Pennsylvanian roots and were like, yeah, we go to a restaurant or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Come Up Clutch in Toronto mentioned that there's usually light food stuffs, finger foods, veggies. Emily works at a cadaver lab, which is super cool, and says that once a year they do a reception for the families of the people who have donated their bodies to the lab and bring in like coffee and cakes and small sandwiches. So again, like
that's
nothing
awesome.
Big, but like just light, like afternoon food.
Yeah, I love that.
And Casey seconded the Mormon funeral food, but also mentioned Jewish funeral food, which I didn't know a lot about.
Yeah, what do they eat?
So apparently at Jewish funerals, there is an emphasis on circular foods. So like lentils, bagels, eggs. And that's because the circle in this context symbolizes eternity and regeneration.
Huh.
It's like rebirth.
Yeah.
And it was neat. You know, I thought it was cool how, you know, like my family uses food as just like, we're all going to have a meal together.
Mm-hmm.
And then other cultures use food as like a symbolic way, like the Jewish circle thing and Kaliva, beyond just having people in the same room. Another example I found of food and death intersecting were dead cakes.
Dead cakes?
Dead cakes. So I'm going to have you go ahead here and read an entry on dead cakes from the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
In the Balkan Peninsula, a small bread image of the deceased is made and eaten by the survivors of the family. The dead cakes marked with the initials of the deceased, introduced into America in the 17th century, were long given to the attendants at funerals in old New York. The burial cakes are also still made in parts of rural England, for example, Lincolnshire and Cumberland, and are almost certainly a relic of sin eating.
Hell yeah. Go on. Go on. It looks like you want to explore something.
Well, I made a face. Yeah, I made a face because I want to know, what is sin eating?
So I saved the best for last here. I love the word sin eating. Sin eaters. They kind of sound like Silent Hill characters.
Ooh, yeah.
But they are just people. So, so we talked about how in Jewish tradition, food is symbolic of eternity, and how other cultures use food to symbolize things about death. Sin eating is a global thing, but primarily a Welsh tradition. The Welsh are wild, man. They got that Mawri Lwyd, the horse thing.
Yeah.
And sin eating. So sin eating is a Welsh tradition where they use the actual act of eating to cleanse the dead. So I'm going to have you read, again, from the Encyclopedia Britannica here, an overview of what sin eating is. And it's not just cheat day on your diet. I am lobbing clunkers today, man.
I thought it was funny.
Thanks.
A sin eater is a relative or clan member who consumes a meal and, in doing so, symbolically takes their sins upon themselves, leaving the deceased to progress freely into the afterlife. A symbolic survival of sin eating was witnessed as recently as 1893 at Market Drayton, Shropshire. After a preliminary service had been held over the coffin in the house, a woman poured out a glass of wine for each bearer and handed it to him across the coffin with a funeral biscuit. In Upper Bavaria, sin eating still survives. A corpse cake is placed on the breast of the dead and then eaten by the nearest relative.
Yeah. So, like, the belief at play here is that, like, evil and sin feed off a person while they're alive. It's like a parasite kind of like eating you from the inside.
Yeah.
But once you die, they can't feed off of you anymore. Or it can't feed off of you anymore.
Okay.
So it gets hungry and flows into food upon death. So at this point, like, this action gets kind of close to the crucifixion of Jesus, where Jesus takes the sin of people upon himself and allows Christians to be cleansed. The main difference here is that Jesus takes everyone's sin, but in the sin-eating tradition, it almost feels like a version of, like, It Follows or something like that.
Yeah, like you pass it on to the next person.
Yeah, like someone volunteers after you die to take your sin upon themselves. And then when you die, you're able to pass your sin on to another person. And it just kind of cycles through people taking sin and being purified and just kind of, I guess, floats around Upper Bavaria until, I don't know for how long.
Yeah. Huh.
But it's really interesting in these cultures because there's, like, I don't know, it just keeps going. Like, the sin just kind of daisy chain flows through a town or from relative to relative. But there are some traditions where it gets a little more bleak. So can you read this excerpt from a 1713 letter by an English antiquarian named John Bagford?
Notice was given to an old sire before the door of the house, when some of the family came out and furnished him with a cricket, or a low stool, on which he sat down facing the door. Then they gave him a groat, a small sum of money, which he put in his pocket, a crust of bread which he ate, and a bowl of ale which he drank off at a draught. After this, he got up from the cricket and pronounced the case, and rest of the soul departed, for which he would pawn his own soul.
Yeah, so this is an instance where, you know, someone volunteers to give their soul up to eat the sin of another person and is, like, paid for this service.
Huh.
Like the, go on.
Okay. That's all I was going to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's intense. Like, when you are summing this up as, like you're pawning your own soul for a meal. And this kind of, like, distaste for that kind of, like, gross action, or what was seen as, like, a dishonorable action, renders sin eaters, like, unclean in a lot of traditions.
Hmm.
So here's another bit from a 1926 book titled Funeral Customs. And this book was written by a man named Bertram S. Puckle.
Great name.
Solid name.
Professor Evans of the Presbyterian College, Carmarthen, actually saw a sin eater about the year 1825, who was then living near Cardiganshire. Abhorred by the superstitious villagers as a thing unclean, the sin eater cut himself off from all social intercourse with his fellow creatures by reason of the life he had chosen. He lived, as a rule, in a remote place by himself, and those who chanced to meet him avoided him as they would a leper. This unfortunate was held to be the associate of evil spirits and given to witchcraft, incantations, and unholy practices. Only when a death took place did they seek him out. And when his purpose was accomplished, they burned the wooden bowl and platter from which he had eaten the food handed across or placed on the corpse for his consumption.
I guess this anecdote is a little darker than what happens in a lot of places where this person is. I don't know if this is a choice or what, but because of one meal or however many sin eatings this person has done, they're totally socially ostracized.
Man.
I don't know if this was like a desperation play by this person to like get food because they were desperately poor, or I don't know, maybe they were just the people in their village who didn't believe in an afterlife and were like, if I can get a free meal, like I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, like what it would take for someone to volunteer for that. I mean, I could see myself like if food is around me, I just eat it. And that's on me, you know, that's an issue. That's a challenge I work through. But I could see myself accidentally becoming a sin eater, you know, like, whoa, who left this perfectly good cheese on grandpa and then snacking on it? But yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound like something that would quite happen there. It's like some like stupid, it's like an Adam Sandler comedy plot line or something. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, the people doing this willingly sign up for being ostracized by society.
Yeah, it's like kind of scarlet lettery or something like that.
All for just eating some food.
And it doesn't even sound like that good food either, like a crust of bread and some beer.
Yeah. And aren't you doing a favor for the dead person in this belief system?
Yeah, I guess you're allowing them passage. You're cleansing them.
Yeah. So fuck you for doing a nice thing by eating their sins. How dare you?
You gotta go live outside the village, you freak.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. This is a very difficult belief for me to understand. It seems a little strange.
I mean, it's like, I get it. Like the idea of transference and purification. But I, you know, I wonder how often these sin eaters would like eat a meal, like how much like sin could your body hold? I wonder, was there a certain point where they were just like, it seems like you're probably full up, but
you've had enough sin. Give me some sin, pass the sin.
Or if it was like It Follows, where you have to like trick someone else into taking it on from you. And you're just like, well, great. I'm clean now. Good luck.
Right. I don't know. It's a very strange tradition. Very interesting.
Yeah. Aside from Wales, there are some instances of it happening in South America. But in those instances, they usually happened where they would take your body and lay food upon it and then take that food and like sacrifice it at the altar of a god. And then the god would like eat the food and like take your sin upon itself. Interestingly enough, in South American cultures, the Aztecs in particular, the goddess who took care of this was also the goddess of the earth. And there was like a correlation or connection drawn there where when you defecate, when you take a large poop,
right,
you bury it in the ground and then it gets reabsorbed into the soil. And in the same way, your like evil deeds were seen as your like spiritual filth instead of your physical filth. So they were sacrificed to the earth goddess. The connection being like, well, we take our physical shit and put it in a hole and it goes away. So let's also take our spiritual shit and put it in like the spiritual representation of Earth and it'll go away.
Sin composting, if you will.
Sin composting, yeah. I think it's really neat. I had a lot of fun learning about this and kind of reading about this connection between food and death, both being like massive parts of life. You know, like I probably spend more time eating than I do a lot of other things.
Sure. It's definitely easy for American culture. Food is like a thing that we kind of get done because we have to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had a recent kind of uptick in freelance work outside of my day job, which is, it's been nice and I'm really grateful for it. But it's kind of crazy how that has you change habits that would normally be healthy and good. Like I know there are times where I've forgotten to eat, which I never thought that would happen to me. But you know, a lot of times people get so busy and frantic that they forget to eat entire meals. And I've even like heard some people just like complain about the inconvenience of having to eat food, which again, yeah. I love food. I will move mountains to get food when I am hungry typically, but it is interesting how that's kind of become, at least in Western culture, a lot of times it's like an insignificant thing that we just kind of have to get done. And it is cool seeing, you know, this is something that's important to people, that they carry traditions with it. And
mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. Even like the concept of comfort food as being like food, or like comfort food or soul food, like food that replenishes not just your physical being, but like your spirits is nice. You know, I love some good like greens and stuff like that. And just like stuff made with lard, like stuff that's not good for you, but just like can heal like a deep soul hurt.
Just makes you feel good, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that people would do that at a time when, you know, people are like really struggling to get over grief and bereavement.
Right.
And like maybe make it better and have like an enjoyable meal shared by people. I like that.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, thanks for putting this together for us, Max.
Yeah, no worries, dog.
And yeah, I mean, just standing off for any time you want to talk about food. We don't have to record a podcast about it. If you just want to talk about food and how good it is and how much we love it, always down for that. Unless it's fucking ham salad.
I'm making potato curry again tonight, so.
Oh, baby. I am definitely going to have to cook some food once we are done recording. So, without further ado, let's get into the post-show spiel here. Thank you guys so much for listening to our podcast and just for all of the support that we've been getting over the course of stay-at-home orders and quarantine and this whole pandemic. We've just had like a bunch of cool interactions with people and a lot of support, both financially and just like, I don't know. It's been really cool feeling kind of connected to people by way of making a podcast and sharing it with people.
We're talking shit about Kansas, apparently.
Yeah. Shout out to Beth, who sent us an email that here it is in its entirety. You ready? Hello. Kansas really sucks and is pretty boring. Sincerely, Elizabeth. That email is pure fucking poetry. And we'll take your word for it. I'm not going to talk shit about Kansas, but if y'all want to talk shit about Kansas, then I won't stop you. Anyway, we love hearing your thoughts, whether it's about anything we discuss on the podcast or how much Kansas sucks. Why don't you talk to us? We are at PreDeadBoys on Twitter and Instagram. You can email us predeadboys@gmail.com and tell us about your home state or country and whether it sucks. If you search Pre-Dead Boys podcast on Facebook, you can find our Facebook group. And again, join our Discord. Message us at any of those outlets and we will send you an invite to our Discord. It's been popping, absolutely popping with fun conversations and interesting death-related news that's come up and lots of adorable animal photos.
If you want to see a lot of photos of my dog.
Yeah, and Julep is just one of the many adorable animals. There's bunnies, cats. I feel like we get some weirder animals every now and then too, and it's much appreciated. It's the good vibes that I need to get through quarantine.
Yeah.
We love it. If you want to support what we do financially, join our Patreon. Patreon.com/predeadboys. You can pledge $1, $5, whatever dollars per month that you're willing to give. And if you donate at the $5 or more per month level, you get access to a lot of good stuff like our bonus episodes. Part two of The Black Parade by My Chemical Romance, our coverage of that, will be out in the Patreon feed by the time you listen to this episode. So sign up. Get access to that stuff. Get some cool wallpapers for your phone and your desktop devices. All kinds of goodies in there. Check it out. If you can't support us financially, that's cool too. You can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and we will read it and give you a shout out here on this podcast. And also, we don't advertise, so make sure you share this podcast with friends. Just tell people about it who would be interested in funny things, morbid things, history of cultures not like our own. We would really appreciate that. Our intro and outro music is the song About Time by Brat Curse. Check them out at bratcurse.bandcamp.com and make sure you look up their stuff on Spotify or wherever you listen to music. And that's going to do it for us. Max, what are you eating for dinner tonight? You said potato curry. Are you like making other stuff with it?
You know, I eat in a very straightforward way where I make like an entree. And we'll eat leftovers of that for as long as I can.
So you don't do side dishes or desserts or anything like that?
No. My wife needs a lot more variance. So, sorry.
Yeah.
I'll have some edamame.
I relate more to her on that front than I do you, typically. But you know what I was thinking for my dinner?
Mm-hmm.
So far today, I've been just a real piece of shit with my Sunday. I have eaten pizza and drink coffee, and that's pretty much it. I think I'm gonna have ice cream for dinner.
Fuck yeah. What kind?
I got a dairy-free almond milk based cherry Garcia from Ben and Jerry's.
Ooh.
It's my favorite non-dairy ice cream. It slaps.
There is a cashew milk snickerdoodle flavor that some company makes, and there's like chunks of snickerdoodle cookie dough in it, so it's like cinnamony and like, oh, it's so good.
God damn. Maybe, you know what, maybe I'll do like a little bit of a platter of different ice creams, you know, like a fancy dinner of ice creams. I'll get a sampling of many different ice creams, all non-dairy though, or else I'll be very sick.
You have a multi-course meal.
Yes. Better be non-dairy or I'll have a multi-course shit. Anyway, thank you guys again for listening. Max and Dorian here reminding you, you're gonna rot.
I'm gonna give her yak stick, which is
yak.
This.
Okay.
It's made of yak cheese and like bone and just raw protein and stuff. And she loves it, and it'll keep her shut up for an hour. Julep.
Nice.
Julep.
You ever try it? I've never had yak cheese.
Maybe I'll try a new one out of the bag. She's she's done a good bit of chewing on this one.
Yeah. Not a pre-chewed one. Yeah. You like to chew it yourself.
Yeah.